Now to another story about Wall Street and the SEC. Late last month, a jury acquitted a former Citigroup executive of fraud. On trial was Brian Stoker, who'd been a mid-level executive at the bank. The SEC had charged him with misleading investors who bought a Citigroup CDO, or collateralized debt obligation. Little review here. CDOs contain a bunch of bundled-up assets, like subprime mortgages, sold to investors, and they're sometimes described as the root cause of the country's banking crisis. Even though Brian Stoker was acquitted, something didn't sit well with the jurors. So they and their foreman wrote a note to the judge expressing their concerns. Bo Brendler was the foreman, and we're reaching him at his home in Paterson, New York. We want to note that we spoke with Bo yesterday, before the news we just heard about the Justice Department announcing that it will not bring charges against Goldman Sachs. In the case of the jury Bo sat on, its note to the judge was written on a sheet of paper ripped from a yellow legal pad and tucked in the same envelope that contained the verdict. I asked Bo exactly what that note said.
Yeah, it was not a particularly eloquent statement. We kind of stitched it together because we were taking bits and pieces from what different members of the jury said, and there was some contention in the jury room as to what exactly to say. We were worried that, if we went on too long, that it would somehow create a problem and nullify the work that we had done. But what we came up with was this verdict should not deter the SEC from continuing to investigate the financial industry, review current regulations, and modify existing regulations as necessary.
And how did the idea for that statement come about?
We had some trouble with cognitive dissonance in the jury room. And by that I mean there's just headline after headline about criminal activity, really, in the financial services industry. So we were torn in the sense that we were given very specific instructions in the trial. We had a 15-page booklet, basically, of instructions as to how to deliberate and two counts to look at that were based on a 1933 law. So we had to be very careful about how we applied the evidence that we heard to the actual verdicts. And the longer we spent, the more time we talked about it, the more it just, really seemed to us that the evidence was not there. So we were concerned about that because we wanted to make sure that the verdict didn't send a message to Wall Street that, juries are dumb, they don't get it. Just really wanted to make sure that we sent a signal that we suspected wrongdoing going on at multiple levels at Citibank.
Right, and unless you're on that jury, it can be hard for outsiders to realize how hemmed in you are in a way by the charges and how narrowly you have to consider different facts related to those charges.
This is certainly something that I've learned being on this jury, is that it's very easy to second-guess what a jury might be doing on Monday morning quarterback, because obviously courtroom trials are part of our entertainment. We see them in movies, and we think that they're perhaps a little bit more simple than they are. But in the course of us doing our work, we were not to discuss the case on breaks. We couldn't go and, Google stuff about Citibank. We had to just literally rely on what we heard in court and what the evidence was put before us.
And ultimately, you decided that you had to acquit this mid-level Citigroup executive, Brian Stoker, but you wanted to send a message with your statement. Now, did you think the judge, or did you hope the judge, would read it out loud?
We had no idea, really, what the protocol of the court was, so it was a surprise to us that he read it out in court, and pleasing to us that the SEC's lead prosecutor came out with a statement, I think, on the day of the verdict, saying that he'd taken our message to heart, I think, and to paraphrase what he said, that the SEC was going to keep on trying to prosecute financial crimes.
Did that seem like lip service to you, or did you consider it genuine?
I consider it genuine. The issue with this particular trial is that the SEC had a very difficult case to prove, and again, this is more hindsight coming in the sense that it seemed to us on the jury, I think, that their case was disorganized. There was a lot of what might seem like a fishing expedition, so to speak. And, of course, we didn't realize until after the trial that this was a particularly difficult case to prosecute because a lot of the witnesses who were being called by the prosecution had ties to Citigroup. They worked at Citigroup. They still worked for one of the other firms that was involved in the CDO. It's very difficult to get people to testify in those situations. We heard a lot of witnesses who just said they didn't remember or they didn't recall. That kind of made the SEC look bad when it really wasn't their fault.
Bo, you've said that one thought was going through your mind over and over as you sat through the case. What was that one thought?
Why isn't the CEO of Citigroup on trial here? It seems to me that it may be difficult to prove a case against somebody at a fairly low level, but if you're the CEO, there's no one above you, and certainly everything that goes on at that company is your responsibility. And I was thinking back to how trendy the management of Japanese companies was in American business literature a while back. And, you know, if you think about Japanese companies, I mean, there's an enormous amount of responsibility taken by the CEOs for how their business operates. And if something is done that disgraces the company, and the CEO resigns, at the least. And here, it doesn't seem that way. It seems like these people can just take another job at another bank, or there just don't seem to be any repercussions. And that's wrong.
So it sounds like you felt like, had the CEO been on the stand, here's someone you might have been able to find guilty.
Yeah. I think it takes a certain amount of guts, prosecutorial guts, to put the CEO of a big bank like that on the stand. But that may be what's wrong with our whole system. It seems like there is this upper echelon of society in charge of banking and financial services and whatnot that doesn't seem to have to play by the same rules as all the rest of us in America. And until we see some public reversal of that trend, what other message are we sending to these people other than you can do whatever you want?
There's an interesting little side note to this, which is that the judge in the case, this is the judge that read aloud your statement, was also the judge that oversaw another case against Citigroup, actually related to the same issue your jury was in the courtroom for. In that case, Citibank agreed to pay a $285 million settlement without admitting that it had done anything wrong. And this judge, who presided over this trial, ruled on that agreement and said it was ridiculous. You know, he called the amount of the fine pocket change for Citibank, and he said the SEC should determine if real fraud had taken place. So this was a judge who, on his own in that case, made the point that culturally we really need to crack down more on the banks. And in this case, he was able to use your note, really, to make a similar point.
It would be nice to think that. I think the point that he is trying to make, or was trying to make in rejecting the settlement, is that the Security and Exchange Commission and I think other government agencies have gotten in the practice of signing consent decrees in which a chunk of money is given up to the government in exchange for the perpetrator being able to say that they accept no responsibility for any wrongdoing, but they've settled with whatever agency for this amount of money. And I think the judge's point is that, you know, the American people need to hear what's going on. You can't just simply broker some settlement between a company and the government and not air it out. I would like to think that perhaps our note helped him in this circumstance.
We're speaking with Bo Brendler. He's a freelance writer who found himself sitting on a jury in a fraud case against a former Citigroup executive. Bo was the foreman of the jury, which found the banker not guilty, but suspected that there had been some wrongdoing at the bank. So the jurors sent the judge a note stating their concerns. We'll have more with Bo in a minute. And later in the show, living as a Sikh in the U.S. since Sunday's massacre in Wisconsin.
I am, for the first time in my life, walking out on the street and people recognizing me as a Sikh, not recognizing me as a stranger or pushing me off as the other. For the Sikh community, this is huge. This has never happened for us before.
That's coming up as the six Sikhs who were killed are being remembered today in suburban Milwaukee. Today's wake and visitation services were initially scheduled to last 2 hours, but they were extended to 4 hours to accommodate the large number of mourners coming in from overseas. That's a little music from the service. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation about the recent trial of Brian Stoker, the former mid-level Citigroup executive charged with misleading investors about a complex financial instrument called a CDO. The jury acquitted Stoker, partly because it thought he was being made a fall guy for the bank's practices. Bo Brendler is a freelance writer who was the foreman of that jury. Before the break, we heard Bo wonder why the CEO of Citigroup wasn't on trial. But there are people criticizing Bo and the rest of the jury for acquitting the banker. When this story was written about in the New York Times, someone from Princeton, Kentucky, posted this comment on the paper's website. I don't understand the jury's thinking. It doesn't matter whether one held the gun, scooped up the money from the teller's drawers, or drove the getaway car. All who participated have committed robbery. I asked Bo if he had thoughts on that.
I would say two different things about that. One is that we were very specifically directed to focus only on Mr. Stoker, and they were very specific about what we were to find. I mean, I have also seen some people compare this trial to the Nuremberg trials.
The just following orders kind of defense.
The just following orders thing, right. I mean, it just seemed to us that a bunch of people should have been on the stand. And to just simply convict one was not, given the instructions that we were given, supported by the evidence.
The just following orders idea here would be, even if you're a mid-level executive, an excuse shouldn't be, my bosses told me to do it, so I did it.
Well, Stoker never really said that. I mean, he didn't say that he was only following orders. That was not ever his take. And also, there was a memo that showed what one of the senior executives at AMBAC, one of the parties that lost many, many millions of dollars on the CDO, he said that this is a very, very risky investment, but the upside of it, if it's successful, is too big to pass up. You know, this is an opportunity we can't resist. So it's as if greed was the order of the day, and there wasn't a lot of particular framework or rules and regulations around what these people were supposed to do and not do.
Bo, one of your fellow jurors was a 23-year-old named Travis Dawson. He lives in the Bronx, and he spoke to the New York Times later, and he told them that after sitting on the jury, he thought, and these are his words, wow, greedy, reckless behavior really does happen on Wall Street. Did you come out of that courthouse feeling similar, feeling sort of newly stripped of any innocence you may have had about the financial industry?
Yes. There were things that shocked and surprised me. One of the difficult aspects of the evidence in the case is that there was evidence presented by the prosecution that Stoker tried to market this toxic CDO to another firm called, I believe, Princeton Investments, and also tried to market it or was considering trying to market it to some South Korean pension funds. We couldn't really do anything with that because part of the law that we had to deal with said that money would have to change hands. And as it turns out, both Princeton and, I believe, the South Korean pension funds rejected the CDO squared, so you couldn't very well say that it was part of the charge.
This Travis quote, you know, he said, you hear sort of generally this idea that Wall Street is an evil place, right? But it's just sort of like a catchphrase, but you really have nothing to base it on. But he said after he sat through this case, he thought, wow, that really is the case. And I wonder if you came out feeling that way too.
Yes, I was particularly dismayed by looking at some of the prosecution's evidence about the market in itself. I mean, there were a couple of graphics that the SEC put up that showed, you know, what banks exactly were interested in or were involved in the CDO game. And I mean, there was the logo of the bank I pay my mortgage to. And I thought, you know, why are these banks who have consumer money allowed to behave like investment houses, you know? We have consumer banks who, because of deregulation, are allowed to bet these enormous sums and indulge in legalized gambling. I mean, you know, it's bad enough that the investment houses do it, but when they start putting up home mortgages, some of the slides just basically depicted that this whole time of creating these very risky securities, or this whole process of creating these very risky securities, was based on home mortgages. I'm a homeowner, you know, and I thought, my God, you know, I'm trying to make my mortgage, and these people are using hundreds of thousands of mortgages to basically gamble. And no wonder the housing market crashed. No wonder the economy crashed. Why didn't they know better? These people have degrees from Harvard Business School and all these other fancy universities. What do they teach them there? Not ethics, I guess.
It sounds like you feel very strongly about this, like this case has really lingered with you.
It has. I have a mortgage to pay, and if I'm a week late with it, which I've never been, I would get, you know, a phone call or a letter. I don't think I could just sort of simply say that I can't pay my mortgage this month because I'm considering investing in swampland in Florida or whatever, but it seems that different rules apply to the banks, and that's not American. It's un-American. They should be subject to the same types of good business practices and good corporate behavior that, you know, we as citizens are expected to comply with as part of being a larger society.
So, Bo, what do you hope comes of that note that your jury sent the judge? What do you hope it ultimately achieves?
I was fortunate enough to talk to the chief prosecutor for the SEC after the trial. He said if I had put several of the other executives who were named during the trial and who were on the witness stand and obviously had some involvement in this, would that have made a difference? And my answer to him was, yes, absolutely it would have. So what I would like to see happen is that the SEC and this new consumer bureau that just levied a $280 million fine, I think it was, against Capital One for deceptive credit card marketing, let's put some senior executives and some CEOs on trial. Let's levy some fines that actually hurt. Let's send some people to jail. Let's really try to treat these people the same way that regular citizens would be treated if they failed to pay their income tax or ran out on their own home mortgage.
And we'll be looking to see if the SEC takes any of those actions.
Yeah, it seems that every week there's a headline about some aspect of the financial industry that's being found guilty of some kind of wrongdoing. So I don't think it's over by any means.
Bo Brendler was the foreman of a jury in an SEC case against a former Citigroup executive. Bo, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for your interest.
Monday on Here and Now, could the answer to how to fix our healthcare system be found on the island of Nantucket? A new book follows an eccentric doctor there who's available 24/7 to his patients, makes house calls, and hands out a cell number. And still ahead today, remembering the victims of the Sikh temple shooting. News is next, Here and Now.